right? So if I put all my money in some tiny crypto and it goes up 10% in a day, like I could feel like I made some huge progress, but then the next day it might go down 90% and I've essentially lost everything. Whereas investing, that slow and steady march towards wealth, is essentially a guarantee to fabulous wealth, but it's slow and not exciting.
Welcome back. We are on today with my guest, Jeremy Schneider, on the Tool for Digital podcast. I'm your host, Angie Sorensen. So it's really nice to be on today, and I'm really excited about this episode. It's really unusual compared to what I normally do, but I think it's really important because I feel that I cannot be the only one out here worrying about the future, pension, money, not understanding what to do, what not to do. And you have all these people, you know, who want you to get on their foreign exchange trading calls or onto whatever. Oh, yeah. And then buy crypto, sell, buy crypto. I mean, all kinds of stuff, right? I've fallen prey to it. Not for too long because I see the light eventually. But yeah, it happens. Before we go into the episode, I just want to say that if you have any questions or thoughts from this episode or any other episodes you've listened to, I want to hear from you. You can message me directly on my website, which is angie-s.com/contact. I have the link as well in the show notes. If you enjoyed this podcast, if you love this episode, don't forget to press like, give it a 5-star rating, leave a review, follow it, subscribe, however the platform you're currently listening on lets you show that you're enjoying this, please do it. I so appreciate it. Every time you do it, it really helps this podcast expand, grow, and get in front of more ears. Okay? This is such an important thing. It really does make a big difference. So if you have a second and you haven't done it yet, hit subscribe, hit follow. It is free to do so. Leave a review, do a 5-star rating, share with friends. And, you know, I realized something earlier today. So I went for a walk this morning before I started to edit this episode. And, you know, when you walk down the street, like, and you just walking the same, like, you've been walking it 1,000 times, so you know it by heart. You could probably close your eyes and just walk around the block and you'd find your way home, okay? So when you're like walking like this, do you ever like get lost in your thoughts and you don't even know how you did the last 20 steps? Like you don't remember those because you were just lost in your thoughts. You were like future forecasting a scenario, or you were lost in some sort of like debate that you would potentially have like at work or something. Well, so I was having this morning where I was just thinking of something, and then all of a sudden I was like, oh, like, you know, I got out of it. And I was just like, it just made me think of, it's a little bit like virtual reality. It's almost like we have our own access to virtual reality. You know, like you have it in dreams, right? You're dreaming. It feels really real, especially if you become lucid in your dream, right? But you also have that when you get lost in your thoughts. And all of us, I think, are guilty of this, right? We are doing the dishes. We're thinking about something. And then you weren't even looking at what you were doing because you were just lost in whatever you were thinking about. And it can really feel real, right? I mean, if you start to future forecast like a disaster, you can almost like feel the emotions of it. And if you are future forecasting something really happy and joyful, you can feel that too. So yeah, just a little thought I was going to throw out in here in the intro. And then also a little announcement, A little announcement is that I'm going to take a little break from releasing episodes, but I will be back. I just need to take some time off and regroup, and I can't wait to do that and come back with some more amazing guests. So just need to give my little time off, and I will be back. So this brings me to today's episode with Jeremy Schneider. We are talking about money. Not just money, but the difference between investing it, saving it, Are you looking at long-term, short-term, and what's speculating as well? Like, what are the things you need to be aware of? And it sort of doesn't matter where you're starting. Like, if you're starting from scratch or not, he really gives you some really golden nuggets. You'll hear me in the intro. I've heard him on another podcast before. I've, you know, followed him on Instagram and checked out what he's posting. And I really wanted to bring him to you. So I'm really excited to be releasing this episode with you today because honestly, it's useful. I am doing the steps that we've talked about in the episode. So watch this space. And look, without further ado, please help me give a big, warm welcome to Jeremy. Let's begin. Hi, Jeremy. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Angie. Thanks for having me.
Now, I'm really, really excited to have you on the podcast because I did snatch you up from the Life is Blurry podcast. I heard you on there. And then I did a little bit of social media vetting to make sure, like, you know, that you were who you said you were. And then I looked at your website, all kinds of stuff. And so I'm just really glad that you said yes. And, you know, the reason why I have you on today is because I want to talk about how we get intimate with, you know, how to get intimate with your money, basically. Like, so we can become financially more savvy and independent. And I promised myself a little while back that I really needed to get intimate with my finances and the numbers. And let me tell you, Jeremy, it was a very terrible first date. I looked at the future and the potential was not bright. It had no, like, zero match with what I had in mind for my future. It was a complete letdown. So in the same way as I believe that most romantic endeavors are salvageable, I have to believe the same with my finances, okay? So I am currently dating money again. I'm just trying to get my head, you know, we're getting to know each other again, all that jazz. And it's not all bleak, you know, money and I are making strides in the right direction. So maybe we'll go steady. So obviously, one thing is that I realized that had I dated money 20 years ago, when I say money, I don't mean a man, I mean actual my money, right? So 20 years ago, I would be in a much more stable situation. And I know I'm not the only one who feels like this, like, oh my God, like I should have started saving 20 years ago. I'm in my 40s. What's happening? Okay. So, but what ifs don't matter. We can't go back in time. So we need to work with what we've got. And so we're all in situations we are in because of the choices we made. And so I want to help, you know, just because I've really started to really get into it and really look into this. And I'm like, this should be taught in school. And I really loved your approach when I listened to you on the podcast and also on your social media feed. Everything is very easy to digest. Just you make it very just realistic, you know. You're not like, oh, people with a hedge fund, you know, hedge fund babies, that's how they're gonna save money. Like, it's just like the everyday people. So and obviously it'd be interesting to see if, you know, maybe I would do an episode in a couple of years time or in 10 years if I'm still around and see where I'm at with this whole, like, what's happened with, like, how I've invested my money. So before we dive in, Jeremy, please introduce yourself, where you live and what you do.
Sure. Well, congrats, by the way, on looking those money, that money relationship in the eye, because that's scary. And I think money does have this, like, people don't like talking about it. And it has this, like, all these social faux pas. And so, you know, despite it maybe being a bad first date, things get better from there. And taking that first step is so important. I'm Jeremy Schneider. I live in San Diego, California. I retired at the age of 36, and now I'm 42. I basically have, since I retired, focused on my passion, which is helping people learn about personal finance and investing. I don't know. It's kind of like some people really like skydiving or wakeboarding or much more cool things. I love talking about index funds and frugality and basically, you know, people like you, where you can change your future by making some simple steps now to improve your, you know, your financial foundation and investing and building wealth and all that great stuff to hopefully, you know, improve your life.
So Okay, so can I just ask, because obviously you just said you retired at 36, like as if it was nothing. It is not nothing, Jeremy. And I want to know, like, obviously I heard your story. I know how you got there. But can you tell us, like, how you got to retire at 36? Like, how did that even happen? And did anyone teach you about investment and money? Like, how did you get to here?
Yeah, so in college, I studied computer science. And I turned down a job offer from Microsoft as I was graduating. And so this was back in 2003. And Microsoft back then was like the premier tech company. Still not a bad company to work for, of course. I decided to start my own company. And so for the next 11 years or so, I grew this little internet company. It started off very rough. I wasn't making any money. I was living on credit cards for 2 years. I had $12,000 in credit card debt, living with roommates, driving old cars. Mm-hmm. The most I ever paid myself, once we were making enough money to give myself a salary, the most I ever paid myself was $36,000. Mm. So all my employees were making more than I was. And then at the age of 34, I sold my company for just over $5 million. My share after taxes was about $2 million, which is getting pretty close to retirement money, maybe not at 30s, but then I started investing. And so then at the age of 36, 2 years later, my $2 million had grown to $3 million. And then I decided, you know, my investments were growing faster than my income was at that point. I had a job working for the company that bought my company. And so at 36, I quit my job and basically have primarily been living off of the growth of my investments ever since.
Okay, so you take basically the return, like a part of the interest that, like the money that's basically sitting in investment is growing. And part of that growth, that those interest, like that return on investment, you take a percentage of that and that's what you live off. Like that's one way of how you're doing this.
Exactly. And so, you know, there's a few different ways. You know, when I was in that moment, I was just basically looking at the value of my investments and they were going up faster than my income. And so I was like, well, I could just take some of that. Now that I've learned more about it, there's this concept called the safe withdrawal rate from your investments. And so any given year, the stock market can go up or down. And what I invest in, by the way, is just what's called index funds, which is a very simple, broad stock market investment where you just basically, in the simplest, cheapest way possible, essentially buy all of the stocks. So the growth of all the companies and profits of all those companies are funneled back to you. But you are, just like everyone else, susceptible to the ups and downs of the market. And so the safe withdrawal rate is basically this number that says, hey, based on the historical growth and volatility and inflation of the markets and economy, how much can you basically count on taking out every year without destroying your nest egg, without destroying the principal? And, you know, a widely accepted rule of thumb is 4%. And so if you have $1 million invested, you can take out $40,000 per year and even increase that for inflation every year and never go broke. And so when I had $3 million at 36, that's $120,000 per year that I can take out and live on without ever risking the principal of going to zero.
Wow. Okay. So that's insane to me. Like that's like, wow. Okay. So obviously, like, I mean, a lot of us are a far cry from having like $1 million in savings to like put into investment and that would just like return. So I kind of want to just go back a little bit, like, and just sort of like zoom out and talk a little bit about you a little bit more, and then go into the philosophy, because I know you have quite a particular philosophy that I hadn't really heard before, although it may be widespread, I don't know, but it's that you were the first one I heard it from. So just before we go into that, I just want to ask you, like, why is helping others with their finances, why does that matter to you?
Yeah, well, on a note, I should say, if you're listening to this and you're like, oh, great, this dude sold a company for $5 million, roll your eyes. There's another strategy that works for everyone that can just take a few hundred bucks a month that can get you to the same place. So we'll talk about it later. But
yeah.
So yeah, don't not just yet. But, you know, I love it because, you know, it just, like I said, some people have other passions. When I can talk to someone for 30 minutes, like we are right now, and just like lay out these simple steps, and, you know, I see this like rift in the future where someone goes from maybe being broke and stressed about money today and for their whole life to having more confidence and being building wealth and then being wealthy later in life, you know, you can change that. Even though you can't instantly become a millionaire in a day, you can change your trajectory in a day just by doing some little things along the way. And then in 10, 20, 30 years, instead of, you know, like you said, you're 40, 60s, I don't know how, if you said, I think you said you're in your 40s. I'm 42. So, you know,
I'm 44. 60s,
you're 44. Okay. So we're almost the exact same age. Yeah. So like, you know, but you know, a lot of people who are like our age, like early 40s, say that they're late. It's like, no, like, you know, we have like most of our life, you know, decades and decades ahead of us. And when you're 60, I promise you're going to not, you're going to wish you started when you're 40, right? And between 40 and 60 is like a long time. And 60 is still very young too. And so, you know, when I can like instill some change and see that trajectory change, it really changes people's lives. And I think for the better, and it allows them to live happier lives and maybe even help more people along the way. And that just really pumps me up still.
Yeah. I mean, I mean, it's really nice to hear you say that. And you know, the thing is, money does matter because we do live in capitalistic world.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So, you know, people saying money doesn't bring happiness usually are people who've never experienced what being broke is. And when you're broke, it's extremely stressful. It impacts your health. And it's just when you're broke, you get more and more broke, right? Because you get into overdraft, you pay interest from that. I mean, the amount of interest I've paid to the bank, you know, when I've been broke is disgusting. Like, and I know in the US is even worse. Like in the UK, they've got it toned down, but in the US is frightening, the interest rate they charge when you're overdrawn. But it's just like, so when, now that I'm in a much better position financially, I can actually breathe again. That's actually how it feels. I'm like, I don't have to be at the grocery store making life choices, you know? I don't have to think about what I'm buying for food. I don't have to, you know, all those things bring a lot of peace of mind. And I think maybe that thing about money doesn't bring happiness, it's not going to fulfill you, but it's an essential, of lack of a better word, currency. Do you know what I mean? It's really unless you're going to live out in the woods and live off the earth, which I think that's the billionaire of the future, being able to live off the land. Does that mean, you know?
Yeah.
I think that's coming back around. We need money, and I think, I just want to clear out something just off the get-go, like, and it doesn't matter what the answer is, because you obviously, you have a lot of experience, and I value very much everything that I've heard you talk about previously in the other podcast and on social media. But I just wanted to clarify for the audience, are you a financial advisor?
I am not a licensed financial advisor. I consider myself a very serious hobbyist. I could get my financial licenses if I want, but what I'm doing now with my, you know, my life basically is being a public personality, and it just turns out, at least in the U.S., it's much easier to speak freely about money if you don't have those licenses.
Yeah.
If you are registered and licensed and CFP or whatever, you know, you're basically much more strictly watched on what you can say, whereas I, as just a regular hobbyist, as I call myself, I can speak more freely. And so, although, I mean, I have employees, and one of them is a certified financial analyst and has all his letters after his name and everything. So, you know, we try to always say the right stuff. But yeah, but for me, I'm a dude who really has nothing to gain from any of this, just really likes it and a serious hobbyist and tries to help people.
Yeah, that's cool. Now, I like to have this like out at the beginning, because then people know, they don't feel like they thought they were listening, you know, because some people have strong attachment to those things, and that's, you know, is fair enough for them. But I just wanted to clear that up. Thank you for that. And so I really want to zoom out. Can you tell us about your thoughts? Like, what's your philosophy on the difference between investing and speculating? Because I hear a lot of people say they invest in crypto. Can you tell me about like the difference between what you think of investing and speculating?
I love this question, because it's this crucial difference that gets at the core of the entire world of investing that so many people get confused with. And it's what like ruins financial lives, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
So investing is when you buy things that pay you while you own them, and they're likely to go up in value. So for example, if you bought a rental property in your area and you put renters in there, just as long as you own it, just the fact that you own it over time, you can collect rent from that property, and homes are likely to go up in value. You know, they're not making more land, and they at least keep pace with inflation, and nice areas generally appreciate. And so just as long as you own a rental property, it's collecting income or collecting rent as long as you own it, and it's likely to go up in value. Same for the stock market. If you buy stocks, they pay dividends. So a dividend is basically your share of the profit of the company. So if you just, for example, buy a share of Apple Computer and you own it for many years, even if you never sell it, you get money as long as you own it. And then Apple is likely to go up in value because Apple is likely to innovate and become more efficient and grow and hire and all that stuff. So that's investing. And people become fabulously wealthy from investing by buying things that pay them while they own them and are likely to go up in value, and just acquiring more and more and more and more. It creates this exponential growth snowball thing. It doesn't happen fast. You know, when you buy a share of Apple, your first dividend payment, if you buy one share for, you know, a couple hundred bucks, your first dividend payment might be like 50 cents or something. So it's not going to be an exciting ride. But if you keep
it's acquiring... it's more than the bank. Like, the bank's not giving me 50 cents of my
Oh, yeah. You know, although with rates changing, maybe that's going to be a little different. But yeah, you're right. Like, the dividends are generally more than the interest you'll get. But still, like, the bank interest ain't that exciting either. So yeah, it's slow at first. But then over time, it builds like a snowball, and then there's this out of control freight train of wealth. But on the flip side, I think what most people get confused with is they see speculation as investing. And speculation is just guessing what's going to happen next. So with crypto, like, is Bitcoin going to go up or down? Because Bitcoin doesn't pay you while you own it. It's just hoping someone buys it for more later. It's just guessing. Mm-hmm. You know, if you are buying gold or oil or day trading stocks, you know, not owning them for years and collecting the dividends and acquiring more, but just guessing which one's going to do better, that's speculation. And speculation has no expectation of building wealth. It's just guessing. It's gambling. You can speculate in Vegas and bet on poker or roulette or something. And so, but speculation is much more exciting, right? So if I put all my money in some tiny crypto and it goes up 10% in a day, like, I could feel like I made some huge progress, but then the next day it might go down 90% and I've essentially lost everything. Whereas investing, that slow and steady march towards wealth, is essentially a guarantee to fabulous wealth, but it's slow and not exciting.
Listen, like, that's the thing, isn't it? It's like, this is what I've come to learn in life, is that boring is the new exciting. Like, you need, like, boring, long-term, long game, that's what it's all about. Like investing, what I heard when you were talking is that investing is all about the long game. It's not about buying some, like, putting money in index funds or stocks and then keep looking at them, like, every day, seeing how much has changed. You know, you're going to give yourself a heart attack. But it's like, it's about the long game, and see how every little amount keeps accruing, and all of a sudden you have this compounding effect, and all of a sudden 10 years later you have like a return, like a big return, versus the short game, right? It's like, oh, is it going to make money? Is it not going to make money? Like, buy, sell quickly. Like you mentioned, was it gold you said was part of speculating, or did I misunderstand you?
Yeah, absolutely.
Is it?
I don't invest in, yeah.
No. Oh my God. What? People always say gold. Do you know what I mean? No. Like, always.
Broke people say that.
Aha. Broke people who want other people to be broke. So why is gold? Because isn't gold the backbone of foreign exchange?
I don't do foreign exchange currency either. So
that's all speculating too, right?
It's totally speculating. So like, let's look at, you know, if you were to buy an index fund is basically, you know, all the stocks in the stock market. And so those represent real companies with profits and growth and income. It pays dividends. There's innovation. There's hiring. You know, when you're buying an index fund, you're buying this like cash generating, profit building machine. Mm-hmm. When you buy gold, you're buying a shiny rock. And that's it. It doesn't.
Yeah. It doesn't innovate. Yeah.
It doesn't innovate. Mm. It doesn't pay you while you own it. Mm. It was just dug out of the ground a while ago, and you're hoping someone in the future pays you more for the shiny rock. And so, it's just pure speculation. And you know, there's like, you know, like the U.S. used to be on the gold standard, and so you could trade in your paper money for gold. But like, you know, whatever. You know, money. The concept of money changes over time. Like, maybe there's a shift with crypto. I don't know. But you know, speculating on foreign exchange, like, you know, exchanging between pounds and dollars or euros and pounds or whatever, you know, you're just guessing what's going to happen. That's not investing. That's just speculation. That's just guessing. But if you're buying companies in whatever currency, or you're buying real estate in whatever currency and holding it for years and acquiring more as time goes on, you're building massive wealth. If you're just buying gold and hoping someone pays you more for the shiny rock, you're just guessing.
Do you know, this is so interesting to hear you say that, because for one, it makes me feel less bad. So I'm really biased here, but like, I did actually try and learn FX. I don't even know how do you call it. Like, you know, basically you buy, sell, like FX trading. There you go. And it's kind of, you know, any of these courses are a little bit like a pyramid scheme, isn't it? Because they say they're gonna teach you, but then they want you to like invite all your friends and family. And I never invited anyone. I was like, no, I just want to learn. But the thing, right, to actually learn it, and they try and make you feel like as if you're in control of it, because you basically look at pattern when you've got all these diagrams and screens, and you look at patterns and you think you're gonna like foresee what's gonna happen to the best of your ability, right? And but the thing is, like, I got really drained of just like, because when I learn something, I want to know everything. So it's like, it's really draining. And so the thing was, is that it's like, it's very different when you are learning the theory and when you're actually trading with your own money, right? It's very different. Like, you know, just, you know, it's very easy to go with fake money when you're practicing, or like with the free credit they give you on those platforms when you start. And the thing is that, what was I saying that for? Is that, yeah, it's a lot of work basically too. And it takes a long time to get really good at it. And usually the ones who are really good at it, I think, are the ones who work for like Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley. They're on the trading floor. They do this all day, every day. And they're not even gambling their own money, right? So, I mean, I don't know.
Let me tell you about that. Because first of all, I think what you're describing is like a literal scam. Like, that's not.
Yeah, I think it is. I got out of it because it did feel really icky. It felt really, really icky. Yeah.
Yeah. And this whole like concept of like looking at charts and doing a technical analysis to predict what's going to happen in the future, it's tempting because if you see this like head and shoulders chart and there's a floor and it's going to, you know, like, you seems like you should be able to know what's coming up next, but it's a lie. And the people running those foreign exchange trading services, it's literally a scam. Like, they're just stealing money. Like, one of, and you even mentioned like all the experts at Goldman Sachs. Nope, they can't do it either. And I'll tell you, one of my favorite stories is about Warren Buffett, one of the most successful investors in history. And, you know, his strategy is what I've outlined. It's just buying things that pay income and go up in value over time, and just acquiring more and more and more. And it takes time, but then it's made him a billionaire, right?
Yeah.
And so back in the early 2000s, there was these Wall Street hedge funds who basically do stuff like that. They day trade, they foreign exchange, they do options, they do, you know, all the tricky financial services stuff you can imagine. And Warren Buffett said, I'll make you guys a bet. I'll bet you $1 million. This is true. He literally bet them $1 million. I think it went to charity because he's a billionaire or whatever. But he said, I'll bet you $1 million that over the next 10 years, I will beat you at building wealth. I will beat you at investing. And here's the rules. I will buy an S&P 500 index fund. I will make one purchase once on the first day of this bet and hold it for 10 years. That's my entire strategy. And I'm telling you ahead of time what it is. You guys can do whatever you want. You can look at the charts for foreign exchange trading. You can use leverage. You can do options. You can buy futures. You can do pork bellies. You can do gold. You can, you know, you can spend all of your resources of these Wall Street geniuses at hedge funds and trade your heart's content. And I'll made one purchase once on the first day. 10 years later, this bet has concluded. The hedge funds had an average return over that time of 2.2%. The index fund had an average return of 7.7%. And so for all of their work, being the experts at the Wall Street hedge funds, they underperformed the simple strategy of buying an index fund by 5% per year, which is like devastating once you understand compound growth. Just like adding 1% per year can almost double your returns over, you know, over decades. Yeah. So 5% per year is the difference between like multi-millionaire and not even keeping up with inflation.
Yeah. I mean, that's, it's interesting because people pay them so much money because, I mean, hedge funds in London anyway, they're famous for like living and breathing money and having a lot of money.
But well, here's the thing about hedge funds. It's like the dirty little secret, because hedge funds aren't in the business of doing better than the stock market. That's not what their business is. Their business is collecting fees from rich people. Mm-hmm, like that's their entire business. And so they basically just need to convince rich people that they're smart finance guys. So if a rich person gives them $1 billion, they say, hey, I'm just going to charge you 1% per year. And then we're going to go do all this work for you. 1% per year for a billionaire. Like, great, no problem. But 1% per year of a billion is $10 million a year. So they get a $10 million a year salary just to go do some nonsense. It doesn't really matter if they underperform sometimes, whatever, they'll go get a new client next time. And, you know, often these hedge funds and these mutual funds, whatever, anyone that's like actively trading just has to like give the impression that they're doing good work, but they're not, you know, they're not in the business of outperforming the market. You know, in fact, you can't outperform the market once you understand the nature of the efficiency of the market and how there's no alpha. Alpha, by the way, is like how much you beat the market by. And the sum total of alpha is zero. On average, everyone who's investing does not beat the market. That's like the bitter reality of average. And so these guys also are fighting over that $0 to be gained.
Well, I think that's interesting because I've heard index funds, there's a, you know, what we call like passive investment and actively managed, I think it's called. So the actively managed, you pay a fee to someone to try and beat the market, right? To basically make savvy investments. But actually, if you just let it roll passively, for one, you don't have to pay such high fees. And for two, you're most likely to actually make a bigger return. So so it's really like, I guess hedge fund, they're a scam for the rich people, right? Everyone's got a scam waiting for them.
That's true.
If we were to go to basics, so let's say, you know, someone's having like, it's just on a regular salary, working in an office job, you know, there isn't much, you know, they can't see they're ever going to make a million so that they can like retire peacefully. Because I want to also talk about how do we know when we can retire? What's the magic number and stuff? So I want to sort of like go to super basic and go, well, let's say you get a salary and you've made, like for me, like I've got like a, what I call a survival budget, right? So I know exactly how much money I need to make to cover my costs every month and how much is surplus. So that's obviously taken work. Like, you know, you have to do your homework, right? But so I've got that number. So let's say someone, they know they have surplus in the income. Do you just then put everything away like for a 10-year investment, or do you put some away for emergency fund and then the rest, like where do you start? Like, do you start with the emergency fund and then put like for long-term saving, or do you do both at the same time? Like, how do you even start?
So much there. So much exciting information to tell you. So first, let me give you a bit of like inspiration.
Yeah.
If you invest $250 per month, and you look historically at what that would do, there has been no, and you do it for 40 years, you know, it's like the average length of a career, maybe a little bit shorter than a career or whatever. There has been no 40-year period in history where a $250 investment in the stock market has not turned into over $1 million. The worst it's ever performed is like 1.2 million. The average is 1.9 million and the best is 3 million or so. And so, you know, at the beginning of the show, when I said I sold a company for $5 million, that's nice, of course. If we could all do that, we would. But everybody has the opportunity. Everybody who's in the sound of my voice right now can absolutely become a millionaire just through this slow and steady process.
Wait. Can I hold you right there? Because I know that's supposed to sound optimistic, but it's not for me because I'm not intending. I don't have another 40 years in me to have a day job at the same time as doing my passion, which is the podcast, right? So I'm just thinking, so you said like 250 a month over 40 years is a million. How about if I was to put like if I was to triple that, put 750, does that mean it will take me 3 times less the amount of time to get to a million?
Unfortunately, no. Because the brutal math compound exponential growth means that the longer you do it, the faster it grows at the end. But the answer, you know, the answer for people of short time frames is you need to put more money in, you know? And, you know, if you're 75 and you want to become a millionaire by 80 and you have $0, you know, that's tough.
Yeah, it's tough.
You know, the math is very bad there. You know, if you're 75 and you want to become a millionaire by 80, those aren't your goals anymore. Your goals should be maintain a comfortable life, make sure that you have food, make, you know, keep your loved ones around you because you might not be living 20 more years or whatever, you know? Mm-hmm. But if you're 44, you absolutely can, you know? And so, you know, $250 a month. And if you're also people who are 44 often aren't starting from zero. And so might be a little bit different. You probably, you know, hopefully don't have zero, but if you mm-hmm. do, it's going to change numbers a little bit. So I actually have a calculator on my website where you can put in your age, how much you currently have invested, how much you're going to put in per month. Then it basically projects out for you how many years it's going to take you to get to financial independence. And then you've got the choice ahead of you, right? You know, like, are you going to buckle down a little bit more, invest a little bit more aggressively, work a little bit longer? And, you know, I wish I could sit here and tell you there's some magical shortcut that's going to make everyone a billionaire in a year or something. There's not, you know?
No, but I guess to put this into a little bit of perspective for me, it's like, it's also like, I know we like to think of like the million, right? Because it sounds like it's the magic number, but isn't there also maybe a different way to look at this? As in, maybe you just need to get to, and I said just, like, I mean, for me, that's a lot. Like, let's say you need to get to 100,000 within 10 years, for example. If you get to 100,000 in 10 years, that 100,000 is also going to start compounding beautiful. Like, not all of us need a million to live off, right? So I guess maybe I should ask a different question, right? So, like, maybe is it like we need to think about, because there's two things, right? I guess two things is, one is how are we going to be able to, actually three things. One is like pension. So let's say if we work and we carry on as normal and we go and we retire when, let's say, we're 65, okay? And then there's the other one, which is like we need an emergency fund. And then there's the other option where, so if we just want to retire, want to make sure that we actually have a good pension, we may not need to really get to a crazy amount of money. But I guess it's more that when we think of like the million, it may be also for us who want to retire earlier, right? That's maybe where that race is for. Or am I looking at this wrong?
Yeah, I mean, if, you know, in the US we don't have a pension, we have Social Security. It's generally not enough to even live on, or if it is, you're basically living in poverty.
Oh, same here. So, yeah, it's same pension is terrible. Yeah.
Right. And so, you know, but that can be part, you know, I don't like to rely on Social Security or pension. Mm-hmm. So I think the goal really is to get to that 4% rule. Basically, it's 25 times your annual spending. If you can get that saved up, invested, then you can live forever off of your investments.
Okay, wait, can I just translate that for a second? So does that mean that, so let's say if you find the magic number of how much you need to live off, and obviously inflation is going to take place, and, you know, and cost of living may change, but let's say if you go, okay, all I need is, let's say to round it up, let's say if all you need is 50,000 a year to live off, what you need to do is you need to time that 25 to know how much you need to have, how much, what your goal is, that's the magic number. Magic number. And then from that magic number, you know that you can actually take out 4%, which is where that time 25 came in, right? So you take out 4%, you're going to get 50,000 a year if you get to that number.
Exactly.
So how much is 50,000 times 25? Is that
1.25 million.
Oh, shit. So you actually do have to get to that number. Okay. Yeah. So 1.5 million
1.25. Is how much?
1.25 is how much you need to get to so that you can make, so you can live on 50,000 a year when you retire, for example.
You know, and that, you know, that's like a relatively pretty conservative number. You know, for example, that's not taking into account your pension. If your pension is going to provide 20,000, then you only really need 30,000 to cover. Also, this 4% rule is kind of like the indefinite number where you can live, you know, it's going to grow indefinitely. If you only need it for 10 years, you can take out, you know, for example, if you only need it for 10 years, you could take out 10% a year and just keep it in cash. And then, you know, you run out in 10 years, right? And so kind of the older you are, the higher you can increase that percentage. But, you know, I think an optimistic way to look at it is like, let's say you get a new job, increase your income a little bit, and you are flat broke. You have $0 to your name. If you save, if you spend half of your money and save and invest half of your money, you will get to that number in 15 years. So even if you're 40 years old, flat broke, $0, and you can make that happen. You know, I'm not saying that's easy, of course. Like if you're living in poverty, it's not easy to start magically saving half your money. But if you can increase your income, get a new job, pick up a side hustle, reduce your expenses, you know, make some changes such that you can do that, 15 years later, from 40 to 55, you can then retire. And so not only is this possible, but you know, being flat broke at 40, you can retire what is exceptionally early compared to most people, instead of 65 or beyond at 55. And so, you know, it's possible to get there, but it requires, just like we talked about, like kind of discipline and the slow and steady approach.
Yeah, you definitely have to be disciplined, for sure. And I think that's definitely probably like motivated by when you look at the numbers and you go like fear runs through your body and you go, shit, I gotta take this seriously now. So I guess, so obviously you mentioned index funds, right? So would you say, like, is it better to have money in several pots? Like, let's say, like in the UK, we have something called ISAs, which is basically like, it stands for individual savings account, and they're basically like tax-free interest. So it's like a bit of a safe, it's like a, that's where like I would put like, that's where like I'm putting my emergency fund in. So like five times my survival budget for like 6 months to a year is where I put it in. And then anything on top, I put like in index funds, right? But then you have index funds, you have bonds. Like, do you think it's too messy to put things in different pots, or like, like, could you be dividing your assets too much? Or is it best to just put everything into one pot and then you get like a maybe more return on your money? Like, how, what's your philosophy around that?
So it's just a reality of personal finance that there's going to, you know, your money's going to get somewhat fragmented, right? You might have a checking account to spend your monthly expenses. You might have that emergency fund account that's separate. You might have an investment account. And generally, the longer you're alive, just these accounts tend to pop up, and there's no negative mathematical disadvantage to having multiple accounts. So for example, and I think inside of your ISA, you can actually invest too. You can invest in like index funds. And so, you know, you might have, but there's a limit to that, right? You can't put that much money in there.
I think it's 20,000 a year is the cap.
Okay. So yeah, you can put 20,000 per year in that, but which is great, which is a ton of money, better than the US, by the way. but if you wanted to do more than that, like let's say you could do 30,000, you know, putting all that into one account, you know, doing 20,000 and 10,000 is just as good as doing 30,000 in one account. The math just works out. There's no advantage to putting it all together.
Okay.
And by the way, I probably wouldn't keep your emergency fund in the ISA because that just pays very little interest. And so you're kind of wasting the benefit of that. The benefit of that tax-free growth is you don't pay tax on all the gains. But that emergency fund that's sitting there in cash, like you saw how much the interest is, it's almost nothing. You're wasting that benefit. And so I would be keeping that emergency fund in a savings account somewhere separate. And then inside of your ISA, that 20,000 per year limit, that's where you put those index funds. And then all that growth you're going to experience over years and years, then you get it all 100% tax free without having to pay any tax on the growth. And so, yeah, the general strategy is, first thing you do is save an emergency fund, right? So if you don't have any cash, like you mentioned earlier, being broke is a very expensive state of
being. So expensive. That's why they say the poor get poorer. Yeah, I mean, it's awful.
Totally.
Yeah, awful.
Like,
yeah.
Payday loans, credit card interest, you know, all the fee, you know, everything. It's just, it sucks. It's a unfortunate nature of the world. And like, now that I'm wealthy, things come for free. Banks want to give me everything, you know, for free. They want. It's like so sick. I'm like, why don't you give some poor people something for free instead of charging them $5 for a, you know, withdrawal or whatever, you know? But that's why you want to build some cash first, because you don't want to get into that debt situation. Then you would pay off what I call your non-mortgage debt. And so if you have credit card debt, student loans, medical bills, car payments, anything like that, because if you're in debt, this beautiful advantage of compound growth that I've been talking about is working, but it's working against you. You know, all that debt you're paying is compound growth for the banks, because you're paying every month and just pouring more and more into it. And so if you can get out of that cycle of debt, aggressively pay those down to zero and open up all of your income to not having to make those payments anymore, but instead thinking in terms of cash and buying things fully instead of just, you know, renting them on debt, then you can go on to the investing step where you're building wealth. And I know it's, if you're listening to this and it's terrifying, you're like, I don't have cash, I do have debt, and I can't even think about investing. You know, just do them in order, you know, start with one thing, focus, try to get one step done, then the next thing, you know, increase the income, stay focused. And then, you know, over the course of maybe 6 months, 12 months, 18 months, you're going to see a lot of progress. And once you see the progress, then it starts to accelerate because you're like, oh, I made some changes and these numbers are moving more quickly. And that's when you really see that long-term progress start to take off.
I mean, it is really like, yeah, taking it by step. I mean, because, I mean, personally, for me, the pandemic was really bad for me financially. I lost a lot of money. So I'm basically starting from scratch. And so, but obviously, I wasn't savvy either. I didn't do any of this investment stuff. Like, you know, I got taken out very quickly. Like, it hurt very, very quickly. So, but I think, like, for me, like, where, I guess what, like, the positive side is that once I got, like, I really fought for, like, a better job, and I negotiated several times for my salary, and I had to bluff it till I got there, you know? And I am really good at what I do in my day job. It's actually a very boring job, but but I had to make that sacrifice because I just needed to, like, I needed to build up back my nest. Like, it was like, that was a priority. And so all of a sudden, once I paid off all this crap and I'm not in the red anymore, things are starting to build up. And so I guess it's like, it's true. Like, if you had said that, if I had heard that 2 years ago, I would have been like, oh, fuck, I can't even think about that. Like, I'm just trying to find where I'm going to find my next, like, you know, pay the rent and stuff. So it's like that. But once you're out of that survival mode, things do actually change quite quickly. All of a sudden, it's like you start to breathe again. And then I think once you're dead, I think, I know I'm not the only one who's felt the sting of the pandemic. And it's not just a pandemic. It's because of other choices I made in my life, right? It was not that alone. But I think, like, that experience made me think, oh, we need to take this a lot more seriously. And I need to really build my future, because at this stage is not pretty. Like, I cannot let this happen again. And I think, yeah, like, getting more money, like, getting real with jobs and stuff, and really negotiate your salary. I can never say that enough. Like, I have so many colleagues who did not negotiate, they just took the first offer. They're in the same job as me. And I'm like, wow, you need better friends. Like, I don't say that to them because I don't want them to feel bad. But when I hear people say they didn't negotiate, it sends a chill down my spine. That's how you throw money down the drain.
Yeah. You know, those, you know, it's just like those little things, like, yeah, getting a raise, negotiating, switching jobs, side hustle, you know, maybe reducing some expenses, cheaper car, cheaper housing. You know, there can be just two or three moves where you might open up $1,000. Yep. Do you say bucks? Do you say quid?
Oh, we understand. We understand. Yeah, a few quids. Yeah. I mean, I stayed in my studio, which I was dying to leave. I really wanted to live somewhere bigger. But I was like, no, let me do one more year here and save. Like, I would have to pay double if I was to leave. Now I can actually save an entire rent, like, just by staying here another year and just, like, biting the bullet. Yeah. And it's worth it because I'm like, I'm thinking of the long game. Like, now that I've got my goal, I'm like, I know how dire it can be. You just have to do it. Yeah,
you talked about earlier how, you know, money makes you happier if you're broke, and that's absolutely true. You know, if you are living in poverty and you can't afford to pay for the lights and you're not sure where your next meal is coming from, money will absolutely dramatically improve your quality of life and happiness. But I think some people get past that and think that that trend is going to keep continuing indefinitely. Like, if you go from making $20,000 a year to $40,000 a year, your life's probably going to get dramatically better. But if you go from $40,000 to $80,000, maybe not so much. And from $80,000 to $160,000, almost not at all. But I think that people keep thinking that there's this, like, it's like they call it the hedonistic treadmill, where I'm like, oh, the next best, next better apartment, or the next better car, or the next better trip. And, like, that's where happiness is. And then you end up being less happy because you just keep spending, living so close to the edge. And so in your place right now, I'm sure there are lots of people who would kill for your apartment, or kill for your housing situation. That would be their upgrade, right?
Yes, yes, absolutely.
And,
mm-hmm.
And so you kind of have to just say, hey, like, don't spend yourself broke. because you're going to end up in a less happy situation. You know, you have to leave some buffer. You have to live below your means and just be comfortable with the fact that that's okay and that's for the better purpose and it's going to make you happier, because the next nicer apartment, I promise you, is going to, that one's going to suck for different reasons. And you're like I currently live in a 2-bedroom condo. Like back when I was broke, making $36,000 a year, I was, you know, I was renting, living with roommates. I was like, man, if I could buy a little studio condo and like have it to my own, that'd be so amazing, you know? And now I have a 2-bedroom condo, 2-bath. That's like a, like 2 blocks from the bay here in Southern California. And I'm like, man, if I could buy a house in the ocean, then I'd be happy. You know, like there's always like the next level that, and the happiness is never around that next turn. So you have to kind of just be, find it elsewhere.
Yeah, you made such a good point. It's true. I think it's like when you're in survival mode, like money truly helps you breathe. It's like, oh gosh, I can just like let my hair down. But you're right. It's like afterwards, like you, there's a different, and even when you're broke, because you have to really make an intentional effort, like being so aware of like finding peace and just being, and just like being in the situation, but you have to keep hope because otherwise you're never going to get out of it, right? So it's like, but once I think, yeah, you're right. I think people can always be chasing. I mean, I don't understand the whole like people want to be trillionaires and billionaires. I'm like, oh my God, I'm exhausted. Just thinking, I can't even read the number. It's too long. Like, how do you fit it in? Like, and good for you if you can get it. Like, it's not that, but it's just like, I think it's, you're right. It's like, to what end, right? Because I think for me, the way I look at money is that it can give me experiences. And that's what I want. I want to have a bit more, it gives me a level of freedom. And I'm not exactly at that level yet. So, which is why, like, you know, I talk to you and I have you on the podcast, because I think, yeah, you're right. Like, even when I get to level of freedom, whatever issues that we have in our personal lives will still be there. You still got to do your inner work or find peace or whatever it is that you need to do, right? To find your level of joy and being okay with the things that suck in life, right? So it's just, yeah, it's obviously, you're right. It's not the chase for happiness either, because you get disappointed.
Right. I think freedom really is, at least my perspective, what money can really buy you. And it's like the most, you know, the one thing that we can't buy more of is time. And it's like the most valuable thing. But I think a lot of people lose out on that freedom because they saddle themselves with stuff. And stuff like the nicer apartment, the nicer car, the fancier clothes, the fancier watch, whatever, that just costs money and it just steals your freedom, right? And so, and there's like these little short-term endorphins you get when you buy something. You know, when I go on Amazon and I get a package in the mail, it's like a little Christmas or whatever. But like, you know, it's very short-lived. And then
it's just like, oh, I got a gift. Yeah.
Right, exactly. But then you're like, then you just have stuff that you have to get rid of and clutters up your life, and it's like stealing your own freedom, because now you have to work more to afford that and work more to make those payments and work more to buy more stuff. And so when you can kind of just like see the bigger picture and say, hey, I'm not going to like chase that short-term endorphin boost that stuff brings me, I'm going to chase like the long-term freedom, I think that's where you can actually improve the happiness in your life.
That's true. And I, you know, it's funny because like I do see there are people at work, you know, and they, like, I guess there's one in particular, and she's in her early 30s, and I understand where she's at in her mind. But now that I'm 44, I'm like, oh my God, no, I can't. Like, I literally get nervous just thinking about it. But like, I see her, she never has the same outfit twice. And I think she buys everything at Zara. So it's not like designer, but still, it costs money. And I'm thinking, you're never going to get a return on that money. Like, that investment's gone down the toilet straight away. You're never going to get a return. And it's great. It's good to look after yourself and feel good. But you're right. It's like at some point, it's like, who are you feeding? Who are you feeding and who are you depleting? You're depleting yourself and you're feeding Zara, who don't need your money, by the way. Like, I'm sure, I mean, I don't know. I don't care if they're doing well or not. Like, it's like, but like, you know, it's like, yeah, it's like we have to be careful what, we have to be aware, I guess, what it is that we're spending our money on. So you may, I've written this question down and I can't remember the context, but I heard that you said you had a 10% rule. What is that rule?
So it goes back to investing versus speculating, where, in my opinion, what's going to make you wealthy is the slow, steady, boring path. Buy and hold index funds. It's a very simple, very low cost investment. You can, you know, get started, put it in your ISA. But a lot of people are constantly tempted by speculation, you know, whether it's foreign exchange trading or crypto or futures or options or whatever.
Or play the lottery.
Or playing the lottery. I mean, you know, I wouldn't recommend that. But but I mean, and people, and so the 90-10 rule is saying, hey, with 90% of your investments, do the sure thing. The thing that's going to make you wealthy, the thing that's absolutely going to build wealth over years, buy and hold index funds, buy and hold real estate, do the sure thing. And then with your 10%, just give yourself permission to go nuts. It's, you know, it's a kind of like a release valve on that FOMO, that fear of missing out, and saying, hey, if I want to try the foreign exchange trading thing, which I don't think you should do, I think it's a scam, but if you want to, go nuts. If you want to buy some lotto tickets, if you want to day trade, if you want to buy some options, if you want to buy some futures, whatever your uncle at Thanksgiving is telling you is the next hot stock tip, like, you know, try with 10%. Most likely that 10% is going to dramatically underperform the 90%. But if it goes to zero, at least you're still in good shape. And if you are some brilliant trader that's going to, you know, do better than everyone else can do, then 10% will be plenty to make you millions, right? But then, you know, because the real tragedy occurs when people get greedy and take that 10% and put all their money in it, and then they see their wealth go to zero.
Let's say if you decided, like, I can put away £1,000 every month to invest. So 900 should go to, like, let's say index funds, bonds, all that long-term stuff, the really boring stuff, low risk. And then £100 should go, like, I can buy like a few lottery tickets, right? But what you're saying is that some people, they switch because they may have won £20 one day and they go, oh, let me put £900 in.
Right.
Is that what you mean by like, well, that's what
totally.
It goes? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. You know, and like lottery is a bag because lottery, the odds are horrible, even worse.
I mean, they're stacked against us, like, you know, completely.
Yeah. But yeah, that's right. Because people, you know, hear stories. And I guess lotto is a good example there where you hear a story of a lotto winner and you think, well, it's going to happen to someone. Or you hear someone buying GameStop stock that went up and they're like, oh, I should do that. But the thing is, like, that just because it happened once doesn't mean it's repeatable, right? And you don't hear the stories of all the people who lose all their money because those aren't good stories. And so it's this kind of this survivorship bias where you just hear these like big fish stories, these things that worked. And so you're tempted to put all your money into it, but it's very unlikely to work again or be repeatable or predictable or anything like that. And so with 90%, do the sure thing. And then the 10% is just to be a release valve on you feeling like you're missing out. And, you know, and if you do buy your lottery ticket or whatever and it hits, then great, you know, you're good, but more likely you're going to lose it all, or at least it's going to underperform. It's going to do worse than the other stuff. And so you don't want your whole portfolio underperforming. You want to keep that very small. And you don't have to do the 10%. Like, some people are not that kind of person. And they're like, I just want to put all my money into something, click buy, and not look at it for 10 years. Those are the best investors. Those are the people who just want to set it up right and not look at it again. Those are the ones who do the best.
That's what I want to do. I want to put my money and not look at it for 10 years. I mean, I will look at it. But like, the point is to not take it out for at least 10 years. I wouldn't even want to touch it. But I think like is... So this is what... So you mentioned like things like GameStop, which I'm assuming is like a company. But... I just want to narrow down to the index funds, because I guess this is what index fund is really attractive to me, right? Because index funds, what it means is basically you buying index funds is like a conglomerate of tons of companies out there floating on the market, like the FTSE. It's like usually the FTSE 500 and the other one, Dow Jones, what's it called?
Dow Jones.
Thank you. Dow Jones. I knew it had a D and an O. Okay, so Dow Jones. And so you get like a whole spectrum of things and that you sort of like bought into. But if one goes south, like at least you have the other 99% let's say if half of them go south, you still have the other half that could still go well. Whereas if you buy, let's say, stocks in one company, like in an airline, for example, you depend on that one company doing well, you know? So I think this is where, like, that's the difference between, I guess, buying stock in one company, where it's actually, to me, it's still a bit of a gamble, where if you spread out, like a portfolio management, like so fancy word. Like I guess it's like that would be like a portfolio, right, of companies that you partly own in a way.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Okay.
That's exactly right. And so yeah, individual stock picking, in my opinion, is more like speculation. It's more like gambling. It's more like guessing. But when you buy an index fund, you're buying all the companies.
And then you let the clever algorithm over the people, the market, do its thing. So I don't have to outsmart it.
Exactly. And in fact, you almost are outsmarting it by guaranteeing, you know, it's like going to the casino and betting on red or black is gambling, but being the casino where you get paid no matter what hits, that's the smart, you know? And so buying an index fund is kind of like being the casino. No matter which stock hits, you own it. And you mentioned like if half go to zero or whatever, you know, half of companies don't go out of business, at least not over any short period of time. But index funds also are what's called self-cleansing. And so they're constantly, you know, the stocks are bought in proportion to their size. And so you buy the most of the biggest stock, the second most of the second biggest stock, the third most of the third biggest stock. And so then as little companies are going out of business, you're buying shares of new little companies. And as those grow, they're growing with you. And so it's got this self-cleansing feature where as time goes on, the bad companies are falling off the bottom, the new good companies are coming up and growing, and your whole portfolio continues to grow and provide income. And so it's basically this foolproof way to build wealth over time. In any given moment, for sure, you know, like 2022 has been a bad year for the stock market. There's speculation built into that. There's some volatility built into that. But over years, it always goes up. It has to, because it's the collection point for all the growth and profits of all the companies of the world.
Well, that's like everything, isn't it? It's like with like houses never get cheaper. I mean, there may be a... Okay, sorry. Let me just rephrase that. In the long term, they never go down in price. Like you may have a dip in the market and it's a great time to buy. Or all of a sudden, it's like a renter's market. And like if you move, you're going to get a really good deal on your rent, right? But over time, the long term, like you never hear a story of someone who said, oh, I bought my house for 20,000 and now it's worth 5,000. Like, you know, like it's always like people bought a house for 20,000 and now it's worth a million or something, right? So right. It's always going to go up. And I think it's like, that's a bit like what you're saying. It's the same with the financial market, like the stock market, right? Like things are going to go up eventually. They may go down for a minute, a year or two, like 2008, 2009, all these little crashes and stuff, but then eventually it goes back up, right? And I guess when you invest, I guess where I went wrong, and this is why I don't want my listeners to go wrong, is like, make sure, this is why it took, that's why the pandemic took me out, right? Is because I did not build enough muscle and insulation over time that it only took, like I was already living on the edge and then all of a sudden that happened and I was fucked. So like, I think like the way to avoid is to basically, when the earliest you start and you build some money, there's, you're gonna be in a much better position. And it's not by shopping at Zara every day, having a different outfit. It's by actually just putting that money away somewhere good, right? So when you talked about index funds, so I guess like if we were, and we don't have to name companies, but like in terms of like, if you decide you want to do index funds, you have to actually, you don't just go into like the London Stock Exchange building and open the door and say, I want to put money here, right? So you actually have to, you go through what is called, is it a broker? And you have, there's different brokers around the world and you just have to, would people need to Google broker for index fund? Is that what you Google?
Yeah. Is most of your audience in the UK or where?
It's half, actually most is in like just by a few percent. It's about 54% is in the US and then the rest UK and then rest of the world. So, okay. Yeah.
So, yeah, it's a broker and it's pretty simple. You know, just like you open up a bank account, you can open up a checking account or a savings account. You open up a new type of account called a brokerage account. And then, you know, checking accounts and savings accounts hold just cash. A brokerage account can hold cash or it can hold stocks or bonds or index funds. And so it's just a new type of account. And so, you know, Vanguard, I think serves the UK, serves
yes.
the US,
yeah.
is one of the websites you can go to where you go to vanguard.com or vanguard.co.uk. I'm sure it will redirect you. And then you click open account. And then you have an account. You kind of follow the steps. And then, it, you know, it takes like 30 minutes to figure out or something. And it's intimidating, you know, to me, it's second nature. And to people who've done it for a couple of weeks, it's second nature. But don't let that intimidation of the first 30 minutes scare you off, right? Mm-hmm. And you know, yeah. On my website, I have a Start Here video series. That's like a free video series. It just kind of shows you what buttons to click and things like that. just to make it a little bit less scary. But yeah, you open up a brokerage account, and you then, you know, the secret is to make sure you don't confuse. It's not a secret, but one important fact is, once you put money into the brokerage account, you're not done. You have to buy an investment. And so I think some people confuse the account with the investment itself. So you have the account, you put money in, and then you buy an investment. Like, that's when you buy the index fund. And that's where you have to like choose which index fund you want. And so in the UK, I know there's these global index funds that basically buy the stocks of the world. And they're even what's called accumulating shares, which means those dividends that the companies pay out, instead of paying you cash and having that cash just sit there, it automatically internally accumulates more shares, which is what you get that compound exponential growth from. And so if I was in the UK, I would go to Vanguard, I would click open an account, I would buy global index fund accumulating shares and just put more money in, and then you're basically done. And then in the US, you would do the same thing, still go to Vanguard, but you can open up either a regular brokerage account or a Roth IRA, which is like our version of the ISA. And then the same thing inside of it, you buy an index fund and just let it go.
Yeah, and actually, you know, I did have a look at Vanguard because you told me about it. And interesting enough, my workplace, so I'm not going to name here, but my workplace, actually, that's the brokerage that they recommend as well. Great. And they know what they're doing. Like, it's a huge company. And actually with Vanguard, because I had some question, I sent them an email and they responded. So that, to me, that's important too, because I feel like, obviously, I don't know how often they would respond if I kept asking them questions, but I sent them a question and they responded. And I was like, that's quite important, because when you're like not someone who has got financial background, to be able to ask like layman questions and someone gets back to you is really reassuring.
Yeah, totally. And
if they didn't respond, I wouldn't even go to them. I'm like, okay, well then, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And you know, once you get comfortable with this a little bit, all the different brokerages are selling you the same investment. You know, in the US, the big three are Vanguard, Fidelity, and Schwab. You can go to any three of those, and they're going to sell you the same thing. They're going to sell you access to the same stock market. One's not going to have better investments than the other. That's not really how it works. It's the same stock market. And so what choosing a brokerage comes down to is really things like the user experience, the customer service.
Yeah.
And you're right to want to be able, you know, I have millions of dollars with a brokerage. And if my account has a problem, I want to be able to talk to someone. You know, that's very important. Like right now, like kind of headline news is this crypto trading exchange called FTX, where this young dude who was running it basically was a criminal and was either just negligent or malicious, who knows, but now has basically lost untold billions of dollars. And everyone who had money with this thing is basically is basically like left with nothing. Which is why I don't recommend crypto, and I haven't for years, by the way. But you know, Vanguard has been around since the 70s and has like a altruistic mission and is owned by the funds you invest in, and has a decades long track record of reducing fees and things like that. And so, you know, just shows another risk of that speculation versus the boring investing.
Yeah, and actually when you said about user experience, what I did, like when I looked at Vanguard, you can basically choose like, that's why I had to email them. So I was like, which ones are index funds? I don't understand. Like, what's the word I need to click on? Anyway, so they responded to me. But then, so once I figured that out, they have like these like ready-made package, if you like, of like the types of investments. So if you're looking for pension or different things, right? They have different things. But what I loved about it is that you can click on it and then the little tab turns around and it shows you how it was done in the last 5 years, like each year, how much money it lost or how much it made. And I thought, oh, that's really good. And then I actually went into my spreadsheet and went like, what does that mean? Like, if I put in this money, like I was just like, then you can start to play around a little bit. And it was good. And so that we talked about that, I wanted to, before we round up, I want to check with you, because obviously there's risk in every investment, right? I want to ask you what the risks are, because obviously, like if we put all our surplus money aside, like what is the risk that you mentioned about, you know, there is no, in the history of of the stock market, you know, 250 a month over 40 years, we make a million, obviously in lesser amount of time, less money, but it usually makes some sort of return. But I'm asking you this question because I wonder, like, what is the worst that could happen? Like, what is the risk when you put in like an index funds? Like, there must be a risk, right?
The risk is essentially the volatility. And so if you are saving up for a house, for example, mm-hmm. and you put 20,000 pounds in there and you want to buy a house next year, the market could absolutely be down between now and next year. You know, any given year, there's about a 70% chance that the market goes up, which is good, but there's a 30% chance it goes down, right? And over time, that all shakes out. And so it always goes up over decades, but over any given year, it could go down. And that's the risk. An index fund can't really go to zero. You can't lose it all. If you put your money in an index fund, that would represent ownership in the biggest companies in the world, like Google and Microsoft and Apple and FedEx and ExxonMobil and Samsung. If you owned all those companies and all those companies went to zero, there would be no more economy.
Bigger problem than your savings, right?
Exactly. And not only that, but yeah. Cash would be no good either. The safe investment. And I would say even gold would be no good. You know, there'd be no more trade. That would represent some, Mad Max economic apocalypse future.
Well, that's when the UFOs come down and we've been beamed up already.
Exactly. I don't know if that's going to happen. So I can't say it's not going to happen because no one knows what the future of the world is. But if it does happen, cash is no good either. And you need to either have canned goods and bottled water or something, to try to survive.
Yeah.
So the risk isn't a risk like it is with, gambling or something in Vegas or at a casino where you can lose everything. The risk is about understanding there's volatility over the short term. And so, for example, if you're saving for a house, I would not be investing that money. It turns out that, buying an index fund is too volatile. There's too big of a risk of the money going down right when you need to spend it on the house. But if you're looking at like a more than a 5-year time frame, now that risk is getting so, so small. There's like been very few 5-year periods in history, and there's been no 15-year periods in history where the market's gone down. And on average, it goes way, way, way up. And so that's when you have to start getting aggressive.
Yeah, I guess it's that way. If you want to buy a house in 10 years' time, that could still be okay, because I guess it's more like if you're looking at more short term, which is like 5 years and under, then you have no guarantee that you're going to have enough for that house deposit, right? To buy the house outright. So that's where the risk is. It's more like about managing your expectations in terms of what goals you set for that investment.
Exactly. Uh-huh. And I found in life there are very few savings goals that are 10 years out. People aren't really waiting 10 years to buy something. And so you kind of just need to separate your savings goals, the things that you want to pay for, like a vacation or a wedding or a home or a car, like that stuff you're just saving for in cash, versus your financial independence goal, which is that investing, which is the retirement wealth building. That stuff should be invested
in like index funds, for example.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So yeah. And the reason why I'm asking, the reason why I brought this up as well is because, someone brought this up to me literally like 3 weeks ago. I was going on about my pension and savings. I was like, shit's gotta I need to change stuff. And she was saying, yeah, because she reminded me of this story that happened in Cyprus. It was around the 2008-2009 crisis. And it was something because obviously because Cyprus has a different status at that time with the EU. Don't get me into the details. I don't know. But basically what it meant is that tons of everyone in Cyprus who had a bank account, $1 out of every $16 got wiped out. And if you were on the higher earning bracket, every dollar to the $10 got taken out. So some people I've got a feeling this is what I just read now, but I'm pretty sure I remember that it was more than that. I remember it was like people's bank account it was the government took out all their money. But obviously many, not all, just a portion, but it's a lot of money when you think about it. That's it's a lot. If it's one out of 10, that's 10%. But it's like, so even having them in the bank, just sitting there, cash sitting there, can actually be a risk.
Yeah.
Obviously, Cyprus is a different situation, but yeah.
There's really no risk-free anything. You know, I think people worry about investing as being risky, but I worry about being in cash as being risky, because this past year, the world has experienced inflation, right?
And yeah,
the $100 or £100 you had a year ago buys about 10% less stuff now, right?
Yeah.
And so you're losing money by letting it sit there. And so you're guaranteed to lose money to inflation. Your money's guaranteed to erode to inflation over time. And so to put it in the safe place is a guaranteed loss too. And so that's just the reality of the world. You know, there's no guarantees. This is real life. We're all going to die one day. We're just marching through life. And so you just need to do some best practices, you know, save, invest, put that money to work. Don't let it sit there in cash, because that's not a sure thing either.
No, it's not. So, wow. Okay. So Jeremy, this was like, we really went to like a few places. Thank you so much. I just wanted, before we go, like find out like, you know, how to find you, and before I ask you all the finishing thoughts, is there anything else that you'd like to share with us that maybe you didn't get a chance to say, or maybe something I didn't ask you? Like, we will go over like about your course and where people find you, because I really want people to really like, you know, go and find your stuff, because it's really, really useful.
I think like the most important thing to take away is not to get too freaked out by all the complexity. You know, when you talk about investing, there's like index funds and ISAs and accumulating shares and it can definitely be an intimidating landscape. And once you figure it out, it's not that hard. But I always end with like my two rules of building wealth, because at the end of the day, it's actually pretty simple. You have to do two exact things to build wealth. Rule number one is to live below your means. You have to spend less money than you make. If you make $500,000 a year and you spend $500,000, at the end of the year, you have zero.
Mm-hmm.
And so no matter how much you make, you have to spend less than you make. And then rule number two is invest early and often. With that money that you're not spending, like let's say you make $60,000 a year and you spend $40,000, if you're just saving $20,000 a year, that's good, but it's losing value to inflation. It's not growing. So you invest. And if you do those two things, spend less than you make, invest the difference, over time, it's a sure thing. You're going to build wealth. And even if you don't get perfect, there is no perfect. There's not a perfect investment. There's not perfect knowledge of the future, nothing like that. So you just have to do those two things. But if you don't do those two things, then you're broke. And so hopefully, if there was anything in this hour that was intimidating, that clarifies things a little bit. And, you know, I always say, don't let perfect be the enemy of good. There's no perfect investment. There's no perfect execution of using your money. It'll never be perfect. So just, you know, spend less than you make, invest the difference, take steps forward. That's what's going to start moving the needle in your life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Living below your means. Such like, it's so simple, but it's so freaking important. Okay. So I'm going to ask you the last two questions I ask all of my guests. I call them the finishing thoughts. The first one is, what do you wish you'd realized at 18? But like really understood on the cellular level, not just like cognitively.
18, you know, that one, I'm so young. The thing that I wish I did differently, or wish I realized, is that how like your body doesn't keep getting better. I remember when I was 18, I would hear the phrase, oh, it's like I'm 18 again. And that didn't make sense to me, because my experience up until that point was every year things get better. You know, you get taller, you get stronger, you get faster, you know, whatever. And I was an athlete in college, and, you know, you kind of have the rest of your life to figure out adult stuff. And I think that I was trying to be an adult too young, and I wish I would have focused more on athletics and young person stuff that you can't do when you're old, you know?
Well, you can always have a middle life crisis, right?
Yeah.
You're allowed to. I mean, you definitely did the grown-up stuff very young, but a lot of us think, I mean, I think the other way, right? I lived a life of like following my heart and my creativity and passion. And sometimes I'm like, shit, I should have actually been more reasonable. But at the same time, I wouldn't change my life. But I think it doesn't matter where you are and how you started. I think we all feel that way. that we wish we'd done it slightly, maybe.
Yeah. But I mean, the other way to look at it is, I'm sure when we are in our mid-60s having the next podcast, we'll be like, man, I wish when we were in our 40s, we were so young, we should have been hiking mountains, we should have been traveling, we should, you know, whatever.
And so, oh, that can still happen. That can absolutely still happen.
Totally. So I'm saying we shouldn't spend our life, even at the beginning you said, you know, you can't, what's past is past, you know, you have to live like going forward. So when I think about giving myself 18-year-old advice, what I really should be doing is like taking that advice today.
Yeah. Yeah. And now you're in a position where you can, right? I mean, if you wanted to just play baseball all day, I mean, nothing's stopping you, right? If you just want to go and travel the world for a whole year, what is stopping you, right?
Yeah, I should.
Mm-hmm. So, and the next one is, what stuff do you not put up with anymore?
I'd say I don't sweat little money stuff anymore. Do you have Chipotle in the UK?
Yeah, it's a sauce, right? Oh, is it no?
It's like a burrito restaurant.
Oh yes, yes, yes. Oh yes, yes, we have those. Yeah.
Okay. They charge you $1.50 or something for guac, and or maybe it's $2, some outrageous amount of money just to add guac. And I'm like, you know what? I'm always getting guac, and I'm not like, you know, I used to like go to the grocery store, like kill myself over looking at little individual prices on comparing brands. I'm like, you know what? That stuff, you know, for a lot of people, even that doesn't really move the needle that much. I think what moves the needle is like the big stuff. And so I'm not going to sweat the small stuff. I'm going to live my life. I'm going to get the Starbucks. I don't drink coffee, but if I did, I would. I'm going to get the guac at Chipotle. I'm just going to like, just like give myself a break on this little stuff and then focus on like the big things in my life that matter.
Yeah. Yeah. I think you definitely should go for the guac. you've earned it. So, Jeremy, where can we find you? How can people like tap into your knowledge? Can they work with you? Like, do you do things online? Like, you know, give us all the good stuff.
Yeah, I don't think I've even mentioned it this whole hour, but yeah, what I'm doing now is called Personal Finance Club. Most of the magic happens on Instagram at Personal Finance Club or on my website, personalfinanceclub.com. And I basically help people with money, help people learn to invest. I've got a free Start Here video series on my website, personalfinanceclub.com. I don't do one-on-one coaching. It's mostly, you know, we do have a more complete course it's $79, so it's not outrageously expensive, but there's no secrets in the course. Everything's available for free on the website and the Instagram as well. But yeah, that's what I do. I just like talking about this stuff and like helping people win with money.
Well, I want to say thank you so much for sharing all of this with us, Jeremy, today. And it's been really useful. It's been really good to talk with you. And I definitely encourage everyone to check your website, your social media, like your Instagram is really useful. And it sort of helped you rethink about money. And I just want to say thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Angie. Thank you for having me. It's been my pleasure.
So that's the episode. And I want to recap the takeaways. So first, build cash so you don't pay interest to the bank every time you're in overdraft, okay? 2, pay off your non-mortgage debts like student loan, car loans, etc. Start to invest often and early. Do one thing at a time. Negotiate hard for that salary when you start a new job. Ask for the raise when you are in a job. Lower your expenses. Side hustle if you need to get extra cash. Get a cheaper car, cheaper house, cheaper rent, whatever you got to do to open up that space so you can put money aside to save or invest. Now, if you are going to go with index funds, you need to 1, open a brokerage account, 2, put money in it, 3, buy the investment. You can't just put money in it and not do anything. You've actually got to buy the investment. So that's it. As you know, I'm going to take a little break, but I will be back. I can't wait to actually have regrouped and be back with my incredible guests. I wish I could skip the break, but I can't skip the break. I need the break. So as always, a big, big thank you for all your support. And don't forget to share, rate, and review this bad girl called Tool for this shit. Take care. And until next time.
Using health inappropriately.